I eat too fast. I really do. I always knew that I ate too fast, but especially once you have a child and they report on your failings to you all the time, you know that it's true. And there are two explanations. One is you can probe deep into the murk of my subterranean psyche and figure out why it is that I eat too fast, but I have a much simpler explanation. I have three brothers. In my house, if you didn't eat fast, it was gone. And by the time, one by one, we all left the house, it was too late, and the habit was ingrained. Because while it is true that parents have a profound influence on what children turn out to be, I mean, look at the bar and bat mitzvah this morning. You know, just by virtue of how beautifully they did and how beautifully they spoke, something about their families. So while it is true that parents have an influence, we cannot underestimate the influence of siblings. After all, your brothers and sisters are your peers. And if they take your food, you learn to eat fast and take theirs. I have a good friend who's a rabbi who told me that when his second child was born, his four-year-old, like so many older kids, was very happy until he realized that the child wasn't going to be returned to the hospital and was staying. And so one day, he was walking to his baby brother's room with a plastic hammer. And my friend said to him, "Where are you going?" And he said, "To fix something." Because sibling rivalry is ingrained in us. We all want the attention of our parents, and we all resent to a greater or lesser degree when someone else gets it. And that is a presaging, a foretaste of what's going to happen with other privileges in life. We don't like it when other people get what we think is coming to us, even if they're close to us. The single most common phrase, as I mentioned before, that you hear from the lips of a child is, "It's not fair." And "it's not fair" never refers to the fact that they got too much and their siblings got too little. It's always, "It's not fair, I need more." So this brings us to the Torah. It starts in the Torah with Cain and Abel, but it doesn't end there. In fact, the Torah has a long history, especially the book that we begin this morning, the book of Bereishit, of recounting sibling rivalries and the destruction that they wreak. And I want this morning very briefly to review that history so that it is fresh in our mind before we come to the first and the last. Remember that after the Jewish people are born, are created in Abraham and Sarah, you have the rivalry of Isaac and Ishmael. And when Isaac comes along, the rivalry is not only in him, but also in his mother, and Ishmael gets cast out of the house. Because there is the sense that these two cannot live together. It's impossible. There's only room in the house for one of them. And as if he hadn't learned from his own experience, Isaac then creates an environment, or at least allows an environment, where Jacob and Esau have the same feelings. And Jacob deceives Esau, and steals his birthright. And in response, what does Esau say? Esau, he says, I'm going to kill you. And that dynamic sets into motion all of subsequent Israelite history. Because Jacob goes away, he finds as he goes away, running away from his brother so that he might live, he finds his wives in Rachel and Leah. He later comes back and has at least a momentary reconciliation with his brother and builds himself quite a large family. But of course, the most memorable story of that family is when all the brothers resent Joseph because his father has bought him a ketonet hapasim, a many-colored coat, and they hate him for it. They hate him for his dreams. They hate him for his privilege. And they, just short of killing him, sell him into slavery. Now all of this begins, of course, with the story of Cain and Abel. Cain and Hevel. And Hevel is a word, by the way, that has resonance elsewhere in the Bible. We just finished Sukkot, where we read the book of Ecclesiastes of Kohelet, where it talks about life as being Hevel Havalim, which means nothing, vanity, useless. And if you read backwards, that is from Kohelet back to Bereishit, you can see that Abel's life, Hevel's life, came to nothing. Because when he was still young and was not yet able to create in the world what he might have created, his life was taken and he was destroyed. Unless, of course, you believe, as I do, that that moment and what befell Hevel and Cain's killing him is exactly what set the tone for all the subsequent stories in the Bible until the end of the book of Genesis. But first, let's look a little bit more carefully at this first story. Why does Cain kill Abel? The truth is, we don't know. The text gives us a hint, but it doesn't say. And then there is an enigmatic sentence that says that sin crouches at the door, Cain, v'ata timshol bo, but you can master it. This idea of sibling rivalry and the possibility of overcoming it is so powerful that not only has it generated works of sociology and psychology and family dynamics, but also is a theme that runs through fiction. And I'm thinking in particular of a book that actually takes as its theme the story of Cain and Abel. It's called East of Eden by John Steinbeck. And if you read that book, you will discover that in the very middle of the book, there is this implausible scene. It is implausible, but the whole book rides on it. So, where some elderly Chinese scholars are trying to figure out the meaning of the story, and especially of the word timshol, which is also the word that ends the book, and they hire a rabbi to teach them Hebrew, and they sit around and they discuss what it is that the story means and ultimately what they decide is that the message of the story is Cain didn't have to do it. He wasn't fated. He could have refrained. And from the very beginning of the Bible, the two stories that serve as the paradigm of disobedience, one Adam and Eve who disobey God, and the other, Cain and Abel, Cain who destroys his brother, both of them teach us ultimately that we can choose. Abel could have lived. Adam and Eve could have listened. But they didn't. And while it is not so important for us today to bemoan their choices, it is important to learn from them. And this brings us to the last story of sibling rivalry in Genesis. I want to remind you once again of the history. You have Cain and Abel. You have Isaac and Ishmael, Jacob and Esau, Joseph and his brothers. There are also other slightly problematic brother relations, but those are the main ones. And then you come at the very end of the book of Genesis, filled with the sense that it is impossible to get beyond this struggle and strife and anger and destruction in a family. And you come to the end of the book, and there Jacob comes down to Egypt because he discovers that his son Joseph is alive. That in fact his other children didn't destroy Joseph, although they almost did, and almost destroyed his own life. And Joseph comes forward to Jacob and he says to him, I have two sons. And already we're worried, because we know what two sons do to each other in the Bible. I have an older Manasseh and a younger Ephraim, and I want you to bless them. So he brings them to Jacob, and he puts Manasseh at Jacob's right hand, which is the hand that gets the dominant blessing, the more important blessing, the greater blessing, the blessing of the firstborn. He brings Manasseh to Jacob's right hand, and he brings Ephraim to Jacob's left. And what does Jacob do? He switches his hands. And Joseph thinks, oh, my poor, blind, doddering father, he doesn't understand. He goes, no, no, you're getting this wrong. You actually want to bless him with your right hand and him with your left. And Jacob says, I know exactly what I'm doing. This one is the one that you get the blessing of the firstborn. It's a powerful scene, but the most powerful part of that scene is what doesn't happen. You know the famous Sherlock Holmes story where Holmes says to Watson, what did the dog do in the night? And Watson said, the dog didn't do anything. He didn't make a sound. What are you talking about? And Holmes says, that's the point. The key here is the dog didn't bark. The key in this story is after Jacob gives the firstborn blessing to Ephraim instead of Manasseh, what does Manasseh do? Nothing. He doesn't scream. He doesn't protest. He doesn't attack his brother. He doesn't yell at his father. He doesn't say anything in anger at his grandfather. He keeps silent and accepts the fact that he has a different role and a different place. And he doesn't even say, it's not fair. In some ways, all of Bereishit is leading up to that moment, even though we usually pass it by. From what we read this morning, it's all about the impossibility of people, when they get close, to actually get along. And yet, all of a sudden, in a moment of sublime silence, Manasseh gives us the answer. And that's why, when you bless a girl on Friday night, you say, Yisimech Elohim Kisara Rivka Rachel V'Leah. God should make you like Sarah, Rebecca, Rachel, and Leah, the four mothers. But when you bless a boy, you do not say, Yisimcha Elohim Ka'Avraham Yitzchak V'Yaakov. You don't say God should make you like Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. You say, Yisimcha Elohim Ka'Ephraim Uchim Menasheh. Why Ephraim and Manasseh? Do they take precedence over Abraham? I mean, the traditional answer is that one of them worked in the fields, that is Manasseh, and one of them stayed and studied, that's Ephraim. And everybody wants a child who can both work and learn. But there's a much more important answer. You should be a child who is able to exploit what opportunities you are given in the world, but also to accept those things that are given to others. That you should be capable but peaceful. That you should be able but not angry. The story of Cain and Abel is all of our stories. Because after all, in the Jewish tradition, every human being is a sister or a brother. Every human being. So our sense of grievance and anger because someone else got something that we wanted or that we deserved, if it can't be, by and large, moderated, solved, negotiated, then we have to choose. Do we take the solution of Cain or the solution of Menashe? It is, I hope, not only the blessings in our families, but the blessing of our people to both learn and to teach the lesson of Menashe. Because in some ways, he is the unsung hero of the book of Genesis. Because it is Menashe who, through goodness and acceptance and a choice of peace, finally teaches us how to undo the terrible legacy of Cain and Abel. Shabbat Shalom.